Welcome to another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast, a production of the Criminal Law Department at the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School in Charlottesville, Virginia. Every 2 weeks, we release a new episode. Today, we're going to have a conversation about a recent opinion from the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Please note that these episodes may contain facts and circumstances surrounding criminal trials. Listener discretion is advised.
Rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable United States Court of Appeals of the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America in this honorable court.
Welcome to another edition of CAF Chats. I'm Major James Barrett, and I'm joined by a regular, Major Dustin Morgan. Dustin, how are we doing today?
James, doing well. How about you?
Good, good. So today we're going to talk about the Coast Guard again in United States versus Shafrand, number 24-0134. This case was argued before the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces on January 15th, 2025, and decided May 12th, 2025. So Dustin, what do we got going on in Shafrand?
Yeah, so interesting charge in this case. So facts aren't super important, but I'll give you just a brief factual background. So accused in this case, Boatswain's Mate Third Class Shafrand was charged with a 120 offense for a sexual assault and also charged with a unique 134 offense. So the specification alleged, and this is directly from the opinion, that he provided several alcoholic beverages to the victim, a person under the age of 21, in the presence of other junior enlisted members of the United States Coast Guard, United States Air Force, and that said conduct was to the prejudice of good order and discipline in the armed forces and was of a nature to bring discredit to the armed forces. The way that this came up was that he met the victim on a dating profile app. And in this app, her profile said that she was 20 years old. She testified during trial that she told him that she was 20 years old and that despite this, he still provided her alcoholic beverages. It was at a party in some sort of soldiers or boatsmen's or sailors or airmen's. There seems to be a lot of services involved here. Living quarters. Eventually charged with a sexual assault and they add this specification to it. The defense objects to it along the way. And one of the things that they object to is what's the mens rea? And that became important because the specification first said that that the appellant knew that she was under 21 years of age. They ended up striking that language from the specification, and then their question became what mens rea had to be shown for this. The judge ruled that the government was required to prove that the appellant acted recklessness.
And that's based upon a previous Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces decision. I believe it was Tucker.
Tucker, yeah. That one was interesting. It looked at a 92 violation for something very similar for providing alcohol to a minor.
And why would, just kind of briefly, I know we didn't plan on talking about this, but it just kind of come up in my mind here. This is a general 134. They didn't assimilate a state statute.
Nope.
They just basically took what is almost common knowledge that you can't consume alcohol under the age of 21 generally, which is a big part of the government's argument here. But they went ahead and put it in a 134 versus Tucker was a 92 saying you will not provide alcohol to a minor under the age of 21.
Yeah, the reason that works is because Tucker was an Army case. And in most Army cases, we have general regulations or general orders that say you cannot drink underage or provide alcohol to a minor. The Coast Guard may not have a similar regulatory scheme or something on like that functioned on this given installation or in this specific area. They also didn't assimilate state law. Maybe there wasn't jurisdiction. I mean, we're kind of left to wonder why they didn't assimilate state law. When they drafted the specification, like you said, it's a general disorder. And you can do that under Clause 1 or Clause 2 by putting those elements either prejudicial or discipline or of a nature to discredit the armed forces. And you have to prove both of this. What was missing from this specification, though, and what the appellant takes issue with on appeal is that the words wrongfully or unlawfully were left out of the specification. And they don't cite any regulation. They don't cite any law. They don't cite any guidance that prevents the accused from providing alcohol to a minor. So like, hey, criminality is missing here. And that's what becomes part of the challenge ultimately to the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces.
And before we move on from the mens rea issue too, it appears the military judge allowed the government to strike the knowing requirement.
Yep.
Thus lessening the mens rea. So is there potential an issue with that?
I know you and I talked about this the other day. That sounds major change-ish to me. So I don't know whether the accused objected to it, whether appellant objected to it during the course of the trial, whether or not the judge found that that was not a major change. But I mean, the RCMs prohibit you from changing the nature of a specification in a way that substantially changes the way that the accused would have to defend against it. Like, that's like a real big distillation of the case law.
And I would think that knowing somebody's under the age of 20 and just recklessly providing them alcohol under the age of 21 might change the way I build my case as a defense counsel.
No, for sure. And one of the things I always teach when I teach major change to our audiences here at the school is a case English that comes up. And the way that I was like, hey, if your defense is going to change as the accused, like if you're going to have to go about showing that you're not guilty in a different way, like that's typically a major change. Like, interesting that that wasn't brought up. Interesting that that didn't become part of the appeal. It leads me to wonder, maybe the defense said it was okay, assented to the major change, maybe, or just maybe that the appellate counsel didn't raise it.
Okay. No, all interesting things, and it's all just related to a 5 or 6 line specification. So, on appeal, somebody catches this as a problem that it may not state an offense, and how do we go ahead and review this?
So it's complicated, like most things when it comes to the standard of review. So initially, like as a threshold question, the court has to decide what the standard of review is here, and it's interesting because RCM 905, which governs failure to state an offense, changed in the interim. And there's a question open whether or not it would be de novo review, as historically it was, or whether you're now under plain error review because of the change to the scheme.
And this is interesting. So by way of background for the audience out there, we are looking at a RCM 905 debate under the 2019 edition of the manual. It is interesting. If you're a regular listener, heard me pontificate at large about how prior case law may not still be good law due to changes of the statute and or RCMs. And it's interesting that in footnote 2 of this opinion, CAF also recognizes that 905 has changed. And they say, and I quote, may have limited precedential value because of the recently amended of the rule. I will note in footnote 2 that they note that Congress amended RCM 905. I'm interested in that. My understanding is an executive order, but...
Yeah, we'll give them some grace there. I don't think they meant that. But, you know, it's okay.
We're all really busy, and I reserve the right to be wrong.
I mean, maybe Congress said something about the RCMs, but yes, traditionally done by executive order.
But it is interesting that in the 2024 manual, the new RCM 905, it takes the failure to state an offense objection and it moves it into the plain error world instead of making an exception for it as it does in the 2019 manual. But ultimately, none of this matters because right. How do we review this?
So it's reviewed under a unique standard that's kind of invented for this type of issue when you fail to raise failure to state an offense at the right stage. It's viewed under maximum liberality. So not a good day for the appellant if the appeals court is looking at the specification with maximum liberality with respect to the government. And that comes from a case called United States versus Turner that was decided about 4 years ago now, where the standard was introduced to the military justice world for the first time.
So in that case, I think the real distinction in Turner is what is meant by trial and what is meant by after trial. And I think the main point of Turner is a trial is the initial session, basically, to the findings. And it's important to note in Turner, the accused made the objection after the verdict was rendered, but before the sentencing proceedings began. And in that case, the CAF came back and said, listen, trial is the verdict. And once the verdict happens, you are after trial. And now we're going to introduce this maximum liberality standard. It's interesting. Some of you may notice that the Honorable Judge Maggs dissented in Turner and said that the maximum liberality for that case was not appropriate because it was made before the adjournment of the court-martial. In this case, he wrote the majority opinion. Am I correct?
He did?
Yep.
Yeah.
And he wrote the majority opinion. But what makes this different is this was not raised until at the appellate level.
Yep.
And so it is, the court-martial had been adjourned. And so I think under both scenarios, he's being consistent in his interpretation of how you view these. But yes, this is made clearly after trial. There's no debate about that because court-martial is adjourned under any standard. And so maximum liberality, walk us through that, Dustin.
So taking a look at it like that, so the discussion in the opinion starts off like really there's two elements to this offense, and we know after Brown that the president has pretty broad authority to establish the elements as long as they're limiting the nature of the offense. And so the two elements are the accused did or failed to do certain acts, and that under the circumstances, the accused conduct is either to the prejudice of good order and discipline or of a nature to bring discredit upon the armed forces. The word that what the defense is basically arguing, what the appellant's arguing here is that it can't be any act. It has to be some sort of wrongful or unlawful act. And the opinion doesn't seem to dispel with this. They don't say like it can be anything. We'll talk about the concurrence in a bit, and we'll talk about how Judge Hardy like would go further. But at least the majority opinion here is still somewhat buying that maybe it needs to be some sort of unlawful or wrongful act. They don't decide that because it's not like within the scope of the case, but they don't dispel that notion either. And the government's like, well, if you're viewing this with maximum liberality, it can at least be implied that what he did was wrongful. Like in Turner, there's nothing in the specification that alleges this was done in a lawful circumstance. There's nothing that makes it indicate that this was otherwise permissible conduct. Just take the specification for what it says and find that it meets a crime. And Judge Maggs ultimately concludes, when you're reading the specification with maximum liberality like they did in Turner, you can find terms to be implied. He found that it was implied that the conduct here was wrongful or unlawful and that the specification did not fail to state an offense.
Well, because also like in Turner, they go back and you can see how the accused defended themselves, yeah. Their strategy, how they weren't misled. It really brings into play the implied elements of the offense, which I know in other scenarios we don't want to get into, but under the appellate standard of this case for reviewing it when the objection was made, this is what we're left with.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that when we come to the takeaways about how like you may not want to reserve this bullet, especially if you're trying to do so for a tactical reason. But yeah, under the standard, you're going to be very hard to win as an appellant.
And so before we get on how the majority ends their opinion, let's talk about Judge Hardy's concurrence.
So Judge Hardy starts by talking about like, hey, the president's the arbiter here. Like we know that from Brown, like they get to decide the elements and really important from his concurring opinion. So neither the text of Article 134 UCMJ nor the president's guidance in the manual impose such a requirement. Here he's talking about wrongfulness or unlawfulness. Acts or failure to act are criminal in the military justice system under Clause 1 or Clause 2 of Article 134 UCMJ solely because they are either prejudicial to discipline and or service discrediting.
And that's, I think, not to put words in his mouth, those are the words of criminality.
That's it. Yeah, that's what makes it criminal.
And part of his main point was in pre-Fossler, we were charging specifications without alleging the terminal element because we thought it was necessarily implied. And under that guise, yes, I would need some type of words of criminality.
Yeah, because pre-Fossler, you weren't even putting the terminal element in the specification. It just would be Article 134, you did this. No terminal element. It's very different charging schema than we've gotten used to in the military justice system today. But he even goes back further than that and is like, listen, under Parker v. Levy, like there's a recognition that the military is just different and we can criminalize this type of misconduct. And he just like, listen, it's that simple. He does go on to say that because these two clauses are what impose criminality, that it is important to prove these. And we've kind of seen that discussed and decided in the case law. I mean, CAF has said just within the last few terms that you must have direct evidence of prejudicial and discipline. In Wells, they refused to extend that to Clause 2, where it's of a nature to bring discredit upon the armed forces. Interestingly, Judge Hardy cites his dissent in that opinion to be like, maybe we should require them to prove it, especially if this is the case. But that's it. It's what makes it wrongful.
And now, let's get to the kind of the takeaway. So at the very end, CAF drop a few line paragraph where they talk about two points bear mentioning. That government, you can avoid all of this by just making sure you put wrongfully or unlawfully in the specification. And then they also ding the trial defense counsel as well by saying, hey, to avoid this maximum liberality argument, just make sure you make the objection to the specification. And notice the very specific word they use, trial. Yep. Make the objection during trial.
Yeah, so for government practitioners out there, for the prosecutors, like just pay attention to what you're putting on the paper. Like you have to make sure that you're not forgetting words like that. If your specification lacks the words like unlawfully or wrongfully, like you might need to take a pause and decide like, hey, am I forgetting something that's real important here?
This is where the bench book and the words of the statute come into play, where you look at the elements of the offense and then make sure that the bench book's model specification tracks, and then just fly spec it.
Yeah, it's interesting that Turner was an Article 80 specification and attempt, and this was a 134 where there's not as much clear guidance, but it's definitely okay to borrow from other parts of the model specifications in the bench book and make sure that you're doing something that's quite similar.
And it goes back to part of our earlier points of maybe not looking at, you know, this case as solely just a how do I draft a novel 134 spec for underage drinking, but generally, how do I draft a 134 spec and have it survive appellate review? Yeah.
And then for defense counsel, there's no point in tactically waiting until after the trial is over to object to this. When you decide to do it, it's up to you. I think there's a bunch of different arguments. Do you want to do it pre-trial? Is there an advantage to waiting till evidence is presented to maybe have the government be on their heels? I've heard some practitioners say, well, I'm going to wait till Jeopardy attaches. I know you and I have talked about this, James. I don't think Jeopardy can attach to a specification that fails to state an offense.
It is unsettled law.
I mean, during the Turner oral argument, the panel of CAF that existed then seemed to be quite sure that Jeopardy would not attach. And they asked the defense appellate counsel, like, hey, don't you agree that this would happen? And the defense appellate counsel smartly answered, well, that's the future defense counsel's problem.
Future problem. No, I was hypothetically maybe sitting there when that happened.
So I don't, it's not worth it, guys, to wait for it. Like, Jeopardy's probably not going to attach. You can think you're being smart, but don't do it for that reason. Like, don't do it for that. Now, can there be a timing reason to mess up the government, maybe dissuade them from bringing it back? Sure. But do not wait till after verdict's been rendered. You're going to end up in this standard and you're going to lose.
I think also more practically, you know, because we're all fond of saying this stuff's hard.
Yeah.
Just make sure it's well thought out and make sure you've identified the issues and then make sure you're making an informed decision. That's usually where things fall apart, is when you either aren't aware that you should be making a decision, you don't make a decision, or you just make a snap decision because of emotion or something along the lines fits with that genre. So just make sure that you're taking a stop, time to stop, think, include paralegals, include your trial team, talk about this with your various tech chains, whether it be DCAP, TCAP, OSTIC, complex litigators, SJAs, deputies, everybody in between. And then once you have all the facts, you can make an informed decision. And then that's why we get paid the quote unquote big bucks.
Yeah, the medium bucks. Turner's here to stay. Maximum Laurality's here to stay. Just be aware of that defense counsel.
Yep. Okay. Well, with nothing else, thank you, Dustin, for joining us for another awesome episode of the CAF Chats. I'll remind the audience out there, keep letting us know whether you're enjoying these. And then if we messed anything up, you know how to find us. And then, yeah, thank you all very much for your support. And we're glad to be here. Thanks, Dustin.
See you next time.
Thanks for joining us today for another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast. If anything you heard sparked a thought, we'd love to connect with you. Your comments help us create better future content for the field or the fleet. Reach out to us on Facebook or Instagram. The information can be found in the show notes for today's episode. The views expressed in today's podcast are those of the presenters and not necessarily the Judge Advocate General's or the Department of the Army or the Department of Defense.
Thanks, counsel, for both sides. The court will stand in recess until further order of the court.